talk today about the refuges, taking refuge, and the process of taking refuge. Is there anyone here who's really new to the practice and has never taken the refuges? Okay. I always loved the phrase, take the refuges. I remember, my gosh, anybody remember the Fire Sign Theater? The line about, we threw an I Ching out the window. Take the refuges. The refuges are considered the three jewels of Buddhism in many circles. The three of them are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And taking the refuges, like taking the precepts, is a matter of usually in a ritual setting. We recite Pali phrases, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, and we do that three times each. And often that's pretty much as far as we get. In retreats, usually we take the refuges and we take the precepts. And and often we don't really give a lot of thought to what these things are and what we're doing with them. And so what I'd like to do today is to just to explore some of that, because in a very real sense, what brings us, what makes us followers of the path, is our relationship to the refuges. And the word refuge, just to start, the word refuge is, I suppose we have an idea of what it means, but we're in this particular context, refuge from what? You know, it's not that nobody recognizes the stress of life. There's a Bruce Springsteen song I particularly like. He says that the times are tough now, just getting tougher. This old world is rough, it's just getting rougher. Cover me, come on, baby, cover me. I'm looking for a lover who will come on in and cover me. This whole world is out there just trying to score. I've seen enough, I don't want to see any more. From the dissatisfaction in the world, we're looking for a refuge from the disappointment, the unsatisfactoriness that's built into our lives, the first noble truth, that it comes with the territory. And of course, we try to fix it. And we have this undying hope that we could. And we even project the dissatisfaction. We don't take it personally. We say, well, more or less, I guess I'm sort of okay, but the world is really a mess. Which is really projecting that dissatisfaction out on the world. And what would a refuge be? Where would be a place of safety? You know, in Hawaii, is it on the Big Island? Have any of you been to the City of Refuge on the Big Island? You know, it's really tiny, but it was, I guess, as beautiful as Hawaii was, it was pretty brutal to live there under the old culture. If your shadow passed over the shadow of the king, that was a capital offense. And unless you could make it to the City of Refuge, what, is about, as I recall, maybe, what, 50 yards square? Is that about right? Right on the water. And, you know, there's a low fence. Who knows how high it was at the time, but it's a rock fence. And if you can get inside there, you're safe, and that's as long as you stay there. It doesn't change the world around at all, but it makes you safe. We think of refuges, people look for refuge in all kinds of things. I mean, the list of things, you know, from, oh my gosh, from work to alcohol or drugs to TV or some kind of, you know, sensual indulgences that become out of control. Addiction becomes a habitual form of, you know, trying to find safety, refuge in some kind of activity. Because we're looking for a lover who will come on in and cover me. So in the Buddhist tradition, we're looking for refuge from dukkha, from the dissatisfaction, disappointment. And it's all of our lots. So taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the Dharma, which is generally identified as the teachings of the Buddha, or the Sangha, which is the community. Well, we'll talk about what kind of community it is, but it's generally the community of the Dharma. How is this a refuge? I take refuge in the Buddha. What does that mean? Who do you think the Buddha was? I bet you each of us has a slightly different vision. You know, we don't have a huge amount of information about his life. There is a lot in the Pali Canon, and there's certainly plenty been written about it. Any of you see the PBS thing last week on it? I generally thought it was really nice, although, you know, the Buddha's born out of his mother's side, and she dies 3 days later. No kidding. You know, and there are miraculous birth stories and, you know, stories of all kinds of miracle elements to the Buddha's story. But most of the stories we have are hagiographies. They're like the lives of the saints. They're illustrative accounts of incidents in the Buddha's life that are intended to teach some kind of spiritual story truth. So we don't know a whole lot about him. We have, you know, the myths. There are certainly the myths. But anybody who's played the game of telephone knows what happens over, I don't know, a dozen people. It doesn't take long to figure out what kind of distortions could happen over 2,500 years. But what, not just who was the Buddha, but what did he accomplish? What is it? How do you understand what the Buddha attained? What his awakening, enlightenment, whatever word you apply. Really, each of us has a different notion. The Buddha himself, he referred to himself as the Tathagata. Well, I'll translate it as literally or generally as it is. I'm not sure it'll help. The thus gone. Thus gone. Is that? You know, I maybe you had to be there. You know, who was he? There's this sequence in The King and I where, in the musical The King and I, where there's a dance sequence in the middle, and it's set around Eliza running from Simon Legree, you know, Uncle Tom's cabin, and Eliza comes to this river, and she can't get across it, and so she, in the musical, and this was their vision of the Buddha, she prays to the Buddha, and the Buddha freezes the water so she can get across and escape to freedom. You know, sort of a sort of a Christian kind of Buddha. No. There are a lot of people who maintained that he was omniscient, knew everything. And that's interesting because at the time, you know, my guru is better than your guru. Yeah, well, my guru knows everything. Oh, well, my guru knows everything too. And, you know. The Buddha said he was just like us. Really, just like us. And he said, I mean, just like us. We're, you know, we put him out there as someone who attained something, what, that's unattainable? It's a lot of talk in Dharma circles about how awakening and nibbana, you know, often some future lives, you know, we're maybe not this lifetime, but have you heard that kind of stuff? You know, we're not going to. The Buddha said, he was like us and he was able to accomplish it and we could too. And actually we have the benefit of him pointing the way because, you know. But what actually did he accomplish? How do you understand that? You know, there's so many descriptions, of him and who he managed to complete the fulfillment of all the perfections, the 10 perfections. He came to the end of suffering. What other things do you think he, you know, and he was able to see things as they are, without the clouds of greed, hatred and delusion intervening. Sometimes you don't understand how that works. There's an Indian aphorism that I particularly like, which goes, when a pickpocket meets a saint, he only sees the saint's pockets. You see what you're looking for, what's there in your intentions. How could the Buddha be a refuge? As I think about it, it occurs to me that the Buddha as a refuge is just the idea we have of what relief from suffering means, that there's something that is possible, that a refuge is in fact possible, that a resolution to the problems, to the problem of human suffering that the Buddha set out to solve is possible. He said, if it weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to pursue it. And what kind of a teacher was he? You know, there's a tendency to sometimes to take his teachings, and he said, regard them as a raft. Don't cling to them. Use them as a tool. I've been recently thinking of him, I hate to say as a realtor, but maybe as a docent might be a little bit more helpful. But, you know, you go with the realtor to a house and they say, and there's the swimming pool, and look on the roof, the solar panels, and there's the granite counter, and here's, you know, the four. But you're expected to look, you know. You're expected to check it out yourself and to examine what they're pointing at. And the same with the Buddha. You know, he was asked once, do all of your followers achieve the end of suffering? And he said, well, his response was, well, do you know the road to Gaia? Do you know how to get to Gaia? I said, yeah. He said, well, everybody that you tell how to get to Gaia, do they all get there? Well, only if they follow the path. And the Buddha said, just so. You know. So he would point, and we were expected to look for ourselves. He said it was possible to achieve a cessation of the suffering, of the dissatisfaction that we live with. And in this sense, you know, there is some value to study. There's often, you know, a sense that all you have to do is sit and meditate and enlightenment will come. But there is a sense in which listening to the Buddha or studying his teaching some helps you know where to look, you know. And here's the utility room, and this is the nature of suffering, and here's the, you know, practice the precepts, and you know. And then he would say, "Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state." And how do we hold that when we think of those whom we regard with despision, or whatever that word is in a noun form? So the refuge in the Buddha is the refuge in the notion, as you understand it, however you understand the Buddha's awakening. And it will change as your study and practice deepens. You may have noticed that already. What were his teachings? Refuge in the Dhamma, in the teachings of the Buddha. You know, most simply, the Buddha said, don't make things worse. Try to make things better and cultivate your mind so you know how to do that. But there isn't a lot of labeling in spiritual teaching the way there is on the food packages. You know, this is 70% Buddha Dharma, 20% Vedanta, 5% Christianity, and you know, there's no labeling like that. And so there are a lot of things that get mixed in. In fact, you know, the Buddha taught in a culture that was very different from ours, and a lot of the assumptions that existed at the time that were just second nature were built in to the assumptions about the way things worked. Same way we build in a kind of scientism, you know, some empirical scientific. So what were the Buddha's teachings that were unique? Stephen Batchelor was here recently. Anybody get a chance to see him? He's really quite remarkable. His recent book is titled Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. Or actually, it's a confession of a Buddhist atheist. And there's a little interview with him in the current issue of Tricycle. He has made an effort over the years to try to distinguish what elements in the Pali Canon were elements that the Buddha added to the spiritual discussion, and what ones were already there or taught by other people, and to set those aside and to look just at what the Buddha added as unique. And he came up with four things. The first is the principle of self-reliance. And we go for that a lot. It resonates with us. When he came to town, there's a story where he came to town in the land of the Kalamas, and they said to him, "Well, welcome, Bhante, but you know, we had a guy here last week and the week before and almost every preceding week, and people will be coming, and each one comes and says, my way is the right way and everybody else is deluded. Why should we listen to you? Why should we take your word?" And he said, you're quite right to be doubtful. You're quite right to question. He said, you shouldn't listen to me just because I say it. And he said things like, don't go by what's written in Scripture. He said, don't go by tradition. Don't go by logical reasoning and what you figure out. No. He said, when you know in your heart that what you're going to do, that something you're about to do will be for the benefit of yourself or others, and or others, then do it. And when you know in your heart that something you're about to do will be for the detriment of yourself or others, don't do it. Only you know. There's no bright line here. It's when you know in your heart. And you know, you can have a, he's talking about your intention here, because you can know in your heart you're going to make a good faith, wholehearted effort to do something, and it can fail. And you can't know that something is actually going to pay off the way you intend it to pay off, but the issue is your intention, the intention you bring. Don't go by what's written in Scripture. His last words were, be a light unto yourself. Or actually, my understanding, although I forgot to study Pali in any formal way, my understanding is that the word could also, depending on how it's inflected, could also be translated as be an island unto yourself. A similar kind of meaning, but it's not so much what other people are doing, but know your own intention, what you're doing. So if you do that, what do we set aside? You know, there are a lot of things in the canon that are there. There's all of this stuff about past lives and reincarnation and rebirth, and unless you are sitting on a memory treasure trove of past lives, when we take on some notion about a never-ending succession of rebirths on the basis of some other external authority, somebody's telling us, we're hearing it from somebody, it's written in the canon. Don't go by Scripture, he says. Look to yourself, you know. And then there's the issue of all of the concentration states, the exotic jhana attainments. These were not things that he particularly invented. In fact, he, in the beginning of his search, he studied with some meditation masters and is reported to have mastered all of the four lower jhanas and the immaterial jhanas as well, and they were truly wonderful, but then he had to open his eyes and he found himself back in the land of dukkha. And he said, this is not it. There, you know, the Pali Canon, if you've hate to say thumbed through it, but you've taken a look, if you've peeked in there, there's some boilerplate language that shows up a lot about the jhanas. But these were not his particular teaching, although there are people who maintain it, you know, and there is what Gil Fronsdal likes to refer to as the jhana wars, you know, jhana heavy, jhana light, and you know, the jhana is the only practice. I mean, there are people who say if it's not jhana practice, it's not Buddhism. But Batchelor points out that this is the second thing that the Buddha particularly was the mindfulness practice that we do. You know, mindfulness practice, which he outlined in the Satipatthana Sutta and said was the direct way to liberation. The word in Pali is sati, S-A-T-I, sati. And it comes, the derivation of that word comes from a verb which means to recollect, to remember. And in a very real sense, we are, you know, mindfulness is about remembering to be attentive to what's present. You know, I just love Joseph Goldstein's comment about how mindfulness is not hard to do, but remembering to be mindful is hard to do. It's hard to do when you sit down and close your eyes with the intention to stay mindful of your breathing. Even then, when you focus and sit, and anybody, isn't that your experience too? You know, sort of. But being able to recollect, to be present, to notice just what our experience is in the present moment. And sometimes we get confused about, you know, where it's. I mean, the breath is a focus. It's an anchor. And often we work with our intention, with our focus, mindfulness of the body and movement, but it includes all aspects of our experience. You know, the moth flies into the flame. Ajahn Jumnian likes to talk about the moth flying into the flame. You know, when we are captivated by the desire for an object, like the moth, we only see the object. The moth sees the light. It's the only thing that's bright. Everything else is dark. But what it's not seeing is its own compulsion to move to the flame. So we can be mindful, but not just of the objects that are in our mind, but also of our own reaction to them and the compulsion that arises, the response, the reactivity that arises. We're talking about presence of mind, bringing the mind and the body to the same place rather than being absent-minded. Absent, the mind is somewhere else, often la-la land. It's a particularly important element in the seven factors of enlightenment. It's the first. It's the first element to cultivate. It's part of the Eightfold Path. And the factors of the spirit, the five spiritual factors, it's the one that's balanced. It's the one, it said you can't have too much mindfulness. You can have too much energy. You can be so absorbed in concentration, insight doesn't arise. But mindfulness is balanced between the energetic responses and the calming, concentrative responses. The Buddha says all things can be accomplished by mindfulness. Mindfulness is necessary to practice the precepts. It's necessary to see clearly. It involves all of our practice. And it's, of course, something that we do ourselves. We see clearly for ourselves. This self-reliance, it fits completely with that. You know, if the Buddha walked in the door right now and said, you know, all that stuff about the noble truths and this mindfulness, I was just kidding. You might say, well, all right for you, but, you know, I've noticed some of this and I've got my experience, you know, through direct experience. The third of the elements that the Buddha, that Stephen identifies as unique to the Buddha is the structure of the Four Noble Truths. There are a lot of metaphors that talk about the structure of the Four Noble Truths. The first truth and actually, you know, interesting. Some scholars like to they balk a little bit at the use of the phrase noble truths. They say actually it's not that the truths are noble, but they are ennobling. To see them and understand them and to relate to them can be ennobling. And the first is the recognition that dissatisfaction, dukkha, suffering, as is translated, unsatisfactoriness, disappointment, that comes with life. And the second is that the cause is grasping at things that cannot be, trying to make things permanent, satisfactory, and lasting. The third truth is the truth that it's possible, cessation is possible. And how we understand that is, it's like our refuge in the Buddha. This is the salvation, if that word applies in this context. And we skip over it a lot. It's brushed by frequently. But the Buddha said it was possible. And the fourth truth is the truth of the path to the cessation of tanha, of craving, of grasping, of suffering. And often these four truths are the metaphor that's often applied that you may have heard is, you know, it's a medical model for the time. The first truth is the diagnosis, dukkha. And the second truth is the cause of the illness, which is tanha, craving. And the fourth is the third truth is the prognosis, which is that healing is possible. And the fourth is the medicine. But Stephen says that it's interesting that you can proceed through these four truths, recognizing that each one is conditioned by the preceding one. So that first it's important to recognize dukkha. We don't see it so much because we often, like I said earlier, we often project it out onto the world. We think the world is a mess. We're sort of okay, but the world is a mess. Of course, what we think is a mess, somebody else might think is just perfect. Ah, but global warming, well, yeah. But what's going on here is that our dissatisfaction with the way things are is projected out onto the world. We think it's something that inheres out there in global warming, in the way people, well, however we account for global warming, or whether we account for it. There are some people who think that it's a hallucination. They wouldn't use it that way. But, you know, people who think that it's a politically motivated effort to bring industry under control of government, I guess. If I'm misstating, if there's anyone here who feels I'm misstating your position. But, you know, given the way things are and have been, what would you expect? This is just how things are, and our dissatisfaction with them is projected out onto the world, so we don't even notice the dissatisfaction. So-and-so is a so-and-so. Think that we don't even relate to, it's like the moth and the flame. We're not noticing our own response. So the first truth is to recognize deeply the dissatisfaction. Once we can see clearly how deeply that goes in our experience, we can see, you know, the causes. The grasping at permanence, the efforts to make things be pleasant. Always get rid of the unpleasant, make things pleasant. And when we can see those more clearly, we can see our way to the to the cessation, to the letting go. And then we can enter the Eightfold Path. To the extent that we are able to enter the Eightfold Path, it depends on putting aside some of our own immediate impulses to restrain our speech, our action, to practice mindfulness, and to acknowledge that impermanence, unsatisfactoriness are built in. So each of the truths conditions the succeeding one. Actually, the Basho points out that in some places in the canon, the Buddha describes stream entry, the first stage of enlightenment, as practicing the path, practicing the Eightfold Path. You know, it's really the Buddha's prescription. And the fourth item that the Buddha proposed that was unique to him was dependent origination, which includes the realization of the interdependence of everything, nothing left out. This includes anatta, which is often very difficult to understand. It's the one challenging thing. Sylvia said that the first time that she heard the three characteristics of our experience, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self, anicca, dukkha, anatta, she said, well, two out of three is not bad, but I know I'm here. The Buddha isn't saying, no, you're not here. He's saying, it's not what you think. Everything, because everything is interdependent, intercausally related. You say, well, this is my body, but the air in your lungs, the oxygen in your blood, in the tissues, comes from somewhere else. Where's the line? You know, the water that makes up your body may have come from an apple that grew in Washington that was watered by rain that came from China. Where is the line? There is no line anywhere. Everything is in process. There is no thing that is not in change. The elements that make up this pen, 50 years ago, they weren't pen. And in another 50 years, they probably won't be pen again either. So is this a pen? It's a process. We are like a stream, you know. The very elements of our bodies are different from what they were years ago. If you try to think of what in your personality is the same as when you were 10, you might find it difficult to think of anything except that you called yourself by the same name, you know. We are like a stream. There is nothing permanent anywhere, and in fact, there are no things anywhere. There is only process. And that is the fourth of the unique contributions of the Buddha. The refuge of the Dharma is the refuge that there is of the path, of the practice. The Buddha lays out the map, and he gives some instructions for the way to achieve the liberation that you understand he achieved. So taking refuge in the Dharma is to take refuge in the practice of the path that the Buddha outlined. There are some things that are not the Dharma, you know, that get passed along. That were present at the time, you know, and the Vedanta of the Buddha's time included the notion that there was a spirit and entity and essence that permeated the entire cosmos, Brahman. And, you know, the metaphor, you may have heard it taught in Dharma scenes about, you know, the ocean of being, and we are but waves on the ocean, and we appear as waves, and then we return to the ocean from which. You heard that metaphor? That's not the Buddhist Dharma. You know, that's Brahmanical. This essence, this transcendent unity of all things, you know, that's permanent, that's not impermanent, that's not unsatisfactory, that is a self or an entity. It's not the Buddhist teaching. But it sort of seeped in because it was part of the time, and the people who were transmitting it was as much a part of the culture then as the scientism that we live with. Not a lot of devotional practice in the Dharma. You know, not a lot in the Buddha's, in the Pali Canon, in the Buddhist teachings. He just didn't want people to make him an object of veneration. In fact, my understanding is, although I haven't found it in the canon, that he requested that there not be images made of him, which is why there weren't for hundreds of years after his death. The Buddha was represented by footprint, or by a Dharma wheel, other symbols that represented him, but not himself. Devotional practice was not something he talked about. And the Sangha, refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha is, in some sense, a community. Another metaphor that's used in regard to the refuges is that the Buddha was the doctor, and the Dharma was the medicine, and the Sangha is the nurse. Sangha is the community. Well, what is the Sangha? Originally, or at some point, there are people who maintain that the Sangha was the community of the fully awakened beings, the arhats who were around the Buddha. Now, there were 499 of them until the day of the first council, and then Ananda became one, and so there were 500 even, I guess. And they all wore little name tags and said, you know, awakened being on them. And there are people who maintain that. Then the meaning of Sangha is still today thought of in some places as the community of those in robes, the monastics. There's a retreat that I've been going to for years and years down at Vajrapani, down in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's a Tibetan monastery. And in the meal line, there's a little card that sits on the post as you're waiting for line. It says, out of respect, we serve Sangha first. And under Sangha, it says, those in robes. Sangha is for some, Sangha is the community of the monastics. And then sort of we have this notion that we refer to this as our Sangha. The people who come and practice together and work together and study together. What is the Sangha? Well, it's like the Buddha. It's your idea. What do you think? You know, I tend to have a lot more social sciences in my background, so I've got, in my mind, I think of it as the culture of awakening. And so it includes not just the behaviors and the people, but the artifacts as well. My wife has an internet friend. When you live most of your life on the internet, it doesn't matter where these people live. She has a friend who lives in Australia who's very just on the edge of the outback, and she's homebound as well. And she listens to the Dharma talks of Jack and Gil and Sylvia on the internet, and she orders books, and you know, these are cultural artifacts that are supporting her practice. So Sangha, I see Sangha more broadly as a culture that supports our awakening, however we understand that awakening. And like I say, each of us has a different different understanding. So we take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma, and refuge in the Sangha is refuge in the culture of awakening, what enables us to awaken. There's a classic exchange between Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant, and the Buddha, and they're standing on a mound looking out over thousands of monks. I always wonder how he could teach thousands of monks without a bullhorn. But thousands of monks are out there, and Ananda says to the Buddha, "This is pretty important, Sangha. Must be half of the practice." And the Buddha says, don't say that, Ananda. It's the entire practice. It's the context in which we practice. The people we relate to who support our work with the precepts, who support our efforts to awaken, and aren't necessarily saying, well, it's been a hard day on the meditation cushion, let's go have a drink. No, it's the people who support our efforts to awaken and to live in a way that's more supportive of what we know we can do. Taking refuge in the precepts is often done as a ritual kind of activity. Some people, as part of their practice, will in the morning reflect, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. And as such, it can be a mindfulness practice, helping us recall just what we're doing and what we think we're working at. Because this kind of a repetitive practice depends on the intention that you bring to it. It's karmic in the Buddha's sense. It depends on your intention. And it helps us remember, because it's hard to remember to practice and what our practice is about. So what I'd like to do as a conclusion, there's often the way the precepts are affirmed is through a repetitive thing where we all speak out loud and recite a formula. I'd like to do it in a slightly different way, in a more meditative way. You can, and just in a reflective way, each of us individually. So you can close your eyes or not, as you prefer. And just reflect for a moment on your own need for refuge. What refuge would mean for you? What it would be like if you had the wisdom and the insight of a Buddha? How would that insight greet the world? Greet your experience. Seeing without clinging. Those things that are pleasant, without asking that they remain. Knowing what is unpleasant without asking that they leave. What kind of refuge is the Buddha's awakening for you? What practices do you reach for in an effort to arrive at that awakening? How do we depend on ourselves, and where do we reach for help from others? Refuge in the Dharma and the Buddha's teachings and his recommendations, his description of the road to Gaya, the path to awakening. In our lives, how do we practice? Can we recognize the obstacles? And know where our work is cut out? Refuge in the culture of our awakening and the people we know and the studies we undertake. What inspires our practice? Who inspires our practice? What resources that are available in this culture of awakening are underexploited, underused by you? Collect your intention and regard the refuges together. Taking refuge in the Buddha. Taking refuge in the Sangha. Taking refuge in the Dharma. So let me invite any questions or comments or thoughts about, please.
I have part A is, did the Buddha talk about reincarnation? And B, if he did, I'm having trouble putting the idea of reincarnation together with the idea that me and this blanket and the floor are all process. So what reincarnates?
That's a great question. When you ask that question, my return question would be, what makes you think something does?
I'm not convinced that it does, except
that there's all this chatter in the canon.
And atoms and all that are...
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some scholars who think the Buddha didn't subscribe to notions of reincarnation. that the discussions about it that are in the canon, and the Buddha does talk about it in the canon, reflected the cultural understandings of the time that were so deeply embedded, like we know about molecules and atoms, and they didn't. They had a vision of, you know, multiple births, lifetimes, in, you know, and that would creep into the, over time, it's hard to imagine. We played telephone, you know. As much as people might want to pass on the Buddha's teachings in as pristine a manner as possible, some of that's bound to creep in. There are places in the canon, there's a great place in the Majjhima where there's a description of the awakened man, the great man, and it's got the 37 features, and he's got legs like an antelope, and, you know, his hands reach to his knees, and I mean, you think, holy jumping, what, you know, what's wrong with that guy? So there's stuff that's in the canon that's not, that you would look at and pretty much see as added later. You know, there were changes, there have been changes that have been made. And so some of that story might be, but the Buddha said, don't go by scripture. Go by your knowledge of your own heart. It's not so much an epistemological free-for-all, whatever you think is fine. He's not giving you license to think whatever you want. He's saying, know what goes on in your heart. Your intention, you can know. And when it is going to be, when it's causing pain, you will know if you take the time to pay attention. So you can believe in reincarnation or not. Buddha said that kind of speculation is beside the point. Coming to an end of suffering is the point. It's a very big deal in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a very big deal. If you don't, you know, if you don't have experience of it yourself, then you can take someone else's word for it or not. But if you know that you're angry, it's kind of hard for someone to say you're not really angry. It's really okay. You're not, you know, that doesn't work. You don't really want that cookie. I say to my 8-year-old granddaughter, good luck. You don't really want that doll. Oh yeah, right. Not only do I want that doll, but I want all the ones surrounding it. So it's a biggie because it's you know, it comes out of that, but there's no truth in labeling on spiritual practices. So I really like what Stephen did by breaking those things out and pointing. He's not saying there's anything wrong with believing. There's nothing wrong with believing in God if it is, but the Buddha was not big into consolation. His last words were all, well, depending on how you translate it, usually it's translated, all compounded things are subject to change. Strive on with diligence. Or as John Peacock likes to, he updates the idiom and he says, everything's impermanent, get on with it. You know, practice is an opportunity for courage, not necessarily the refuge, is a refuge from dukkha into freedom and life. Any other, anything else? Is that helpful? Or just, well, or more muddy?
No, it is. I'm just having trouble with the process and reincarnation. But.
Well, you're trying to figure it out conceptually, trying to understand. Right. It's, and you know, yeah, there's a sense that if we've got a map of it, it must be true. Sort of like Middle Earth. It's got to be somewhere. Yeah. The map is not the territory. We came to that in the 20th century. What is it? Semantics, first law of general semantics, the map is not the territory. Just because we have an idea about it. And then there's a real issue about this, you know, the unity, unified spirit that underlies all things. If our sensory life is unrelentingly transient, with no sense data coming in that stays the same, you know, how would we even know we were encountering something that would be permanent? How would we recognize it? Is it good feeling? Well, of course, yeah, gotta be. Is it bad? Is it, you know, how would we know? So it's not something that we could even know. Buddha says, if you can't know it, you can speculate about it till the cows come home. They had cows. I don't think they came home. You had to go round them up. Anything else? Well, thank you guys for your attention.
Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Next week.